of this workshop, and I would like to. I'm not sure the title is a good one, but essentially, I'm going to talk about renormalization. Okay, this is an outline. I will talk about the Gross-Vulkenaar model, which is a non-commutative field theory in which there is an asymptotically safe point that one can control completely, and that is not due to supersymmetry. And then I will talk about a much more exploratory program to see whether such mechanisms also exist in group field theory. But let me first say that the main problem in quantizing gravity from the start was identified as a problem of its renormalization, because around a flat background, the ordinary Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian is not renormalizable. And in front of this difficulty, there are essentially two main routes. One could try to add symmetries, because if you add symmetries, you may kill the divergences, because you might put a zero in front of the divergences. This is essentially the route followed by supergravity or superstrings and these kinds of approaches. Or you can search for ultraviolet completion, which is non-trivial, not obvious, not directly readable on the perturbative expansion around flat spacetime of the theory. And I think this is what this workshop is about, and this conference, sorry, is about. And I have learned a lot in the recent talks about impressive progress which has been reported in this direction. So essentially, the two things that I have mostly that have striken me most in the previous talks is that, in fact, non-Gaussian fixed points appear with increasing stability, confidence, and with larger and larger truncations. If I have well understood what has been said by the people talking about the FRG functional renormalization group method, there is a growing or an emerging consensus that really these fixed points seem to be a generic feature in this approach, and they are there. And they give a lot of interest and confidence, as we heard from Steven Weinberg, that it is time to interest again to this possibility that quantum gravity could be asymptotically safe. Then I learned also better about Regge sums and how these CDT simulations allow to avoid the problems of branching polymers and crumpled phases and produce emerging manifolds. So, the question, I think these approaches should not distract us from trying also to construct perhaps a more fundamental theory of quantum gravity. And the question I would like to ask is there such a more fundamental theory on which we could have some analytic or mathematical grasp, at least in some regime, at least in some regime, perhaps not in all regimes, and which would explain the main features of these numerical experiments, namely asymptotic safety and emergence of a large and smooth spacetime. So I have to say that there is one toy model which may be promising in this respect, or which is a toy model. It's a Gross-Vulkenaar renormalizable model of field theory in four dimensions. It is a non-commutative field theory. That is, it is formulated on a non-commutative background, and that's why it is non-local. It is not background independent. So it has one of the, we expect a more fundamental theory of quantum gravity to be non-local and to be background independent. So the Gross-Vulkenaar model has half of the properties which we would like. It is non-local. It allows us to play rigorously with what it is to have renormalizability in a non-local context, but it is not yet background independent. Still, what it has is that quite unexpectedly, was completely unexpected by experts of non-commutative field theory 10 or 5 years ago, even, that it would be asymptotically safe, and that the mechanism for its fixed point could be studied in complete analytic detail, including in constructive detail that is beyond perturbation theory. So that's an encouraging step, we may hope, perhaps, that if we look hard enough, we could find a theory which would be non-local, but also background independent, which would share some of these features and perhaps ultimately explain better the origin of these desirable observations from numerical experiments. So the program I would like to propose is that group field theories, which are both non-local and background independent, may perhaps, if we can reconcile them, if we can reconcile them with renormalization, they may perhaps explain these desirable features of space-time emergence and asymptotic safety. Okay, so this is the problem. Now I am going to have a few very elementary slides now to just to go very progressively. I would like to say, renormalization is a framework to study how the physical laws of nature or degrees of the physical system change under change of the observation scale. And we know that the main tool in this respect is the renormalization group, because it tells us that, like in the trajectory of a dynamical system, it is nice to think to this change of scale, not in a single step, but step by step. Just like the local evolution of a dynamical system is a very powerful tool beyond also global consideration. And it also tells us that scale in a renormalization group is a kind of time. The flow of the renormalization group should be oriented from small scale to large scale. Now, I use the word scale and not the word distance, because renormalizability, renormalized theory is a kind of self-similar theory, some theory in which the structure of the Lagrangian does not change along the trajectory of the renormalization group, only the coefficients change. Now, the question of scale in quantum gravity is perhaps difficult, but let me before very elementarily say, recall what is an ultraviolet or infrared scale and what is really a scale. When we think of a scale, I think we think of a discretized, we don't really think of a continuous scale. We think of it of a discretized, sort of slice in distances or momentum space which relate to roughly the size, for instance, of the object. For instance, I could talk about a kilometer scale or centimeter scale, a nanometer scale. It doesn't mean exactly being 1 nanometer long, but being between, for instance, between a centimeter and a meter. So it is a kind of discretized version of what? Of distances? Well, maybe. At least in quantum field theory, it is common to call ultraviolet the short distances and infrared the long distances. Okay. But there is a kind of standard, this is a kind of standard vision of scales. And in the meter system, we would sit at the middle, you know, we would be a meter-sized object. And we would consider that there is an infrared long distance scales, for instance, bigger than us, and an ultraviolet scale for the smaller objects. And then if we measure the scales in terms of geometric series, then we have a scale index which belongs to Z. For instance, the negative value could explore the small distances compared to a meter, and the large value, the large distances. Okay. Now, should we keep this vision in quantum gravity, or should we change it? I'm not sure we can keep it. The problem is, what is the scale in quantum gravity? Because if we would like to have ultimately a background independent, deeper formulation of quantum gravity, which would make no reference to a particular space and a particular metric. And therefore, the question of what would then be the scale. Okay. So I don't know yet how to answer to this question, but there is one thing which is striking, which is the existence of a preferred scale, the Planck scale. Okay, great. I have also, so I will come to some proposal too, but okay. So one thing we might be prepared and which occurs in the Gross-Vulkenaar model is I will show you that because of the phenomenon of ultraviolet-infrared mixing, in that model, we should not measure the system of scales with an index in Z, but an index in N. There is only a half direction, really, for a system of scales. And this is related, in the case of the Gross-Vulkenaar model, to the non-commutativity of space-time, to the existence of a fundamental scale related to this non-commutativity. And that could be related to the existence of the Planck scale in ordinary quantum gravity. Okay. Now, what is a scale in quantum field theory, and how do you really use it? What is the most convenient way to introduce scales in quantum field theory? Well, there are two views of quantum field theory, essentially. The the functional integral view, which is a bit global, but difficult to use and difficult to define. And then the perturbation theory, which is made of Feynman graphs. And then it is too detailed. It is better to use than functional integral, easier to define. You can even define it in non-integer dimension. But there is a problem, which is that there are too many graphs. So that's why the series typically diverge. Yes?
What about the standard formulation in terms of Hilbert space and operator?
No, well, this one is really cumbersome. I will not discuss it for the moment. But if you want to discuss, you should attack one difficulty at a time. I will not talk about.
Essentially, I will be in the Euclidean world. I will have the statistical mechanics, if you like, view of the theory, which you could also say view with a temperature. And then I will not discuss the Hilbert space formulation. But certainly, the Feynman graphs are nice. And I think they have a lot of qualities, in particular because their structure makes no reference to a background. You know, you could define a graph. It is a purely combinatoric object. And you don't need any space-time to define a graph. Whether to define functional integrals, you need fields. And these fields live on a space-time. So I think, ultimately, Feynman graphs are very nice. But they have a big defect, which is that they proliferate. That is, there are too many graphs at large order, so their summation is difficult. But nevertheless, I will use the graphs, and I will try to say how could we understand scale and renormalization in terms of graphs. Then what happens is that you have graphs, you have the subgraphs within graphs. That's very important for renormalization, and you have external legs to this graph, which may correspond to observation probes. Okay. Yes.
Feynman graphs, the individual.
Not to the Feynman graphs. No, as to objects which could be interesting as a formalism in order to answer some questions which have been unable to answer, which people have not been able to answer, for instance, for functional integrals. But Feynman graphs, no. I don't claim that they will be the fundamental tools. What I think is that they are a model of what we would like to have ultimately, I think.
We would like to progress towards the definition of quantum field theory in terms of combinatoric species, that is, in terms of objects whose definition makes no use of external space-time. But Feynman graphs are like that, but they are not the right ones because they proliferate too fast, I think. But they are a good model of what we have in mind. Yes.
In the CTT, it's entirely defined in terms of combinatorial numbers. Maybe the number of graphs.
Yes. Okay, so then it's indeed. Okay. So now the problem is we also would like to have a formalism which is, you know, based on discretized combinatoric things, exactly like in the CTT, and also one which on which we can do some analytic rather than numerical analysis. But this is okay.
That can also be done in two-dimensional quantum gravity. It's entirely solved by combinatorial means, simply by counting graphs.
Yes, why not?
And in principle, you can do that in four dimensions if you could only count them.
After that, we have some discussion.
I think we should not. Yeah, at this time, what I'm saying is so general that I can accommodate certainly your remarks. But I want to progress towards how to use graphs to define scales. And in graphs, what is important, the important difference between vertices and propagators. So I think a convenient way to introduce scales in quantum field theory is to decompose the action into vertices and propagators. And the vertices, you know, there is a certain freedom into that, because you could also hook to vertices some parts of the propagators and so on. But the freedom should be fixed by saying that the scales, I would like to put them in the propagators. And the vertices should be like topological. For instance, in the local quantum field theory, the vertices should be point, so they should be local. And they should not involve a point. Point-like thing is something which doesn't involve any scale. So propagators, and more precisely their spectrum in this perturbative view of in this view of quantum field theory based on vertices and propagators, then it's the propagators which should contain the information about the scales. Okay. So the definition of a scale for me would be, if you like, so in the Euclidean world, the propagators have positive eigenvalues. And for me, it should be a range of eigenvalues of the propagator. But if the propagator becomes an abstract object which does not live on a space-time, then it could still have eigenvalues,
And if it has eigenvalues, you should cut the eigenvalues according to a geometric sequence of scales, and that for me would be the corresponding scale analysis of the corresponding field theory. Okay? So, and this is particularly conveniently done usually using the parametric representation. If the propagator is a positive operator, it is the inverse of something that I could call H, and therefore it is given by a Schwinger or Feynman representation, integral of exponential minus alpha H d alpha. And then you could simply define the scales by cutting this abstract alpha parameter, which does not live at all in any spacetime, doesn't make any reference to spacetime, into slices. Okay? So in this way, you could, for instance, say that the if slice corresponding, roughly speaking, to eigenvalues of H, which are between m to the I and m to the I plus 1, would be given by the integral from m minus I to m minus I plus 1 of exponential minus alpha H d alpha. And in the case of ordinary field theory in which the propagator is given by the Laplacian, this is perhaps the best adapted method for doing scales on graphs and perturbation theory. Okay, here I assume that the spectrum of C was bounded because I could have, for instance, a map in my theory, and then there would be only half an analysis. That is, this index I would take value in N and not in Z. Okay, so this could be the general definition of scale for models like non-commutative field theories or group field theories in which you don't have the usual intuition on what the scale is, and it might not be related to small distances or large distances. Okay, so in the case of ordinary 5-4, I will be very fast because I have lost a little bit of time. So in the case of the ordinary 5-4 theory on an ordinary space, this would be done like that. You would have a measure like that. You would decompose the propagator according to the parametric representation, and what you see in red would be the heat kernel. That would be the Fourier transform in the parametric space. And then you would see that indeed the decomposition of C as a sum of CI would correspond to analyzing shorter and shorter distances when I gets to infinity. The Schwinger functions would be given by moments of the measure corresponding to this new object. And then the perturbative expansion would be given by transforming the exponential of the 5-4 into a geometric sum. And then the main interest of the Feynman graphs would be that they would be connected objects that allow to perform the computation of connected functions. Okay, and a graph would be an integral over positions of vertices of products of propagation. The scale decomposition would be made like that. And in that case, the slice, as you see, would correspond to a certain value of alpha between m minus 2i and m 2i, and m minus 2i plus 1. And it would correspond to x's, which would be between m minus I and m I minus I plus 1, where m is a number, like 10 or e, if you prefer, e fold. And you would have easily the following bound on CI, which tells you there is a prefactor which reflects the ultraviolet singularity here, and there is a scale, decay, which is a scale decay, which tells you that really at scale I, you analyze points which are close together, roughly speaking, at distance n minus I. Okay? And higher values of the scale index I probe shorter and shorter distance. So what is the recipe for a normalization in such an ordinary field theory? Okay, once you have the scale decomposition, which is important, in a way or another, you cannot do renormalization without having cutoffs. Yes, when you move the cutoff, you see a renormalization group equation. Okay, cutoffs are essential, and even their technical aspects are somewhat important for how do you prove things. Then there is a kind of principle that tells you that renormalization will work. That is some subgraphs when the scales are okay look local. So what I call the locality principle. And then you have to have a power counting, and you have to have a combination of these three things, which tells you that some subgraphs which are dangerous from the point of view of the power counting. We'll just renormalize a small number, a finite number of operators, by the locality principle. So the two first aspects here, scale and locality, in that case are dimension independent. They are very general. But this one can depend on the dimension of spacetime. So we have seen the scale decomposition. So what is the locality principle and the power counting? Well, the locality principle has to do with the subgraphs which are at high scale compared to their external legs. So the idea is there is, if you fix, for instance, a scale attribution for every line of a graph, then you should turn your attention to a particular class of subgraphs which play an essential role, which correspond to, in the Wilsonian point of view, the high energy part of the theory that we should forget or integrate in order to incorporate them to the effective action. So at the level of graphs, there would be the subgraphs, sorry, whose internal lines are a higher scale index than all their external lines. This I would call for short the high subgraphs. And the locality principle tells us that the high subgraphs, when you sort of observe them through their external legs, they look like points. Why? Because they have higher scale index and because they are connected, by the way, would not be true, because they are connected and they have high indices. Okay, all the internal distances in these graphs are short, and the external lines, which are like the probes for which you see the thing, they don't distinguish the fact that they are non-local. That is the locality principle. So this locality principle is extremely general and independent of the dimension. It just tells you that every high subgraph looks more and more local as the gap between the internal and external scales grows. And so you could summarize by saying, when you look at a small thing from far away, it looks like a point. You could explain it to everybody. Then the power counting, well, in that case, it would depend on the dimension. And to do the power counting, you should integrate all the internal vertices of such a high subgraph, save one, which is, if you like, the center of mass, okay, for this, or if you like, the because the high subgraph looks like a point, you have still the coordinate of this point that you should keep for the future integration. Yes. Yeah. This is ordinary. So I put all these things in place to show you how they will be modified when you no longer have such a structure. But the idea would be to try to copy these things. Okay? So here is an ordinary 5-4 theory. Quantum field theory 101. So I am not saying anything new here. So in four dimensions, you would find that only the subgraphs with two and four external legs diverge, and you would find their power counting of divergence by combining the large factors coming from the ultraviolet divergence of the propagators at coinciding point, which is m to the 2i, with a gain from integration of all the vertices except one, that you get by relating them to the center of mass. All right. Then using a Taylor expansion, you could transfer these divergences into a change of the initial parameters of the model, and that's why the model would be renormalized. So I have recalled all these features of the ordinary 5-4 in order to show how they apply and how they are modified in the case of the non-commutative cross-Vulcanar model. And then after that, we will go to the much less advanced situation in group field theory. So this means that the model is renormalizable, and that's all I wanted to say about the ordinary 5-4 model. So now I turn my attention to non-commutative field theory. So in non-commutative field theory, you will still have a background, you will still have a distance, but it will be a non-local theory. So you will discover one of the features that we would like to have for a fundamental quantum theory of gravity, non-locality, and we will see how the renormalizability could resist the arrival of this new feature. And then perhaps later, we'll try the more difficult step of trying to get background in the panel. So the simplest non-commutative four-dimensional space is a flat Euclidean vector space with a constant commutator. That is called the Moyal space. So in that case, instead of multiplying function in the ordinary sense, there is a star multiplication, which is non-local. And this formula shows why and how it is non-local. The f star g of x is not defined solely by the values of f and g at x, but by a superposition of f at x plus y, g at x plus z, and a kind of symplectic area of the triangle made out of x, y, and z. What is now the ordinary 5.5.4.4 model on this space? It has this action. You take one half of you take the ordinary action of the 5.4 model, and everywhere where there was an ordinary product, you replace by this non-commutative product. So there is this non-commutative product is the only one which is associative and associated to this rule. And it has a property to be trivial, that is that the integral of a product of two functions is the same with a star and without the star. So the star doesn't modify anything to the quadratic part here, and therefore it doesn't modify anything to the propagator of this theory. But it completely modifies the vertex of this theory, and this vertex is now non-local. So as a consequence, the Feynman graph expansion of this model is no longer made in terms of ordinary graphs, but in terms of ribbon graphs. Okay? So in ribbon graphs, you no longer have only the number of vertices or and the number of lines which is relevant, but you have also the question of the number of faces which follow the ribbon borders, the number of external lines, and you have the genus with this relation. And you have also something I call the number of external faces, which are the faces which contain arriving external line. And then I will introduce a little notation. I will call a graph regular if it is not only planar, that is G equals zero, but also with all the external lines arriving on one face, which I will call the then single external face. So there will be only one external face. Then this model was introduced, it was under attention at the end of the 90s, because it was realized that it could happen as an effective regime of string theory. So for a brief period of time, let's say 2, 3, 4 years, string theorists were very interested in this model, and then they completely left it. So they tried to see whether it was renormalizable, and they arrived at the problem, which is it was not renormalizable. So what happens is that they discovered, Ramsdonk and Zeiberg, discovered that it was not renormalizable for the following reason. First of all, the amplitudes of regular graphs remain in this model the same than they were in the ordinary model. So first of all, you immediately see that this model in four dimensions will have an infinite number of infinite graphs. So the initial ambition of people who hoped that a non-commutative field theory would give you finiteness is not true. But then they found also an interesting phenomenon, which is that non-regular amplitudes create a new type of divergence, which is of the infrared type and not of the ultraviolet type. So they would be ultraviolet finite, but infrared divergent. And this can be seen on the following tadpole. If you look at this tadpole, which is a non-regular tadpole, because it has two broken external faces rather than one, this line arrives on this face. But this line, you see, goes under and arrives on the other face. So this thing is sometimes wrongly called a non-planar. It is planar, but it has two external faces. It's not regular. Then you see that there is this oscillating factor in momentum space, which, provided this p momentum is non-zero, regularizes this quadratic diversion. So it is not ultraviolet infinite. But, of course, when p goes to zero, this oscillating factor disappears and goes back into one, and therefore you recover the divergence. Therefore, it's not surprising that this function behaves at p close to zero as p minus two. And if you put a chain of such function into a closed loop, you can get an arbitrarily large infrared divergence, and there is no way, because it is of arbitrary order, there is no known way how to renormalize it. So the theory cannot be renormalized. Then, okay, there are many discussions and many possible ways to solve this problem, but I will concentrate on one way, which is the Gross-Vulgenaar model, because that's one which is related to the question of asymptotic safety. So in the Gross-Vulgenaar model, you make a bold assumption. Gross and Vulgenaar, they added a term in the Lagrangian, which is quadratic. So they modified the propagator of the theory, but they didn't modify the vertex of the theory. And a kind of rationale for that is that, in fact, the vertex of the theory has a symmetry which is it is exactly the same. Its kernel looks the same if you look at it in X space, direct space, or in momentum space. So therefore, this was remarked by Langmann and Szabo. And one could say, OK, this is a symmetry that the theory is trying to tell us. Therefore, we should also implement this theory in the propagator. This term has the Langmann-Szabo symmetry. But the Langmann-Szabo symmetric of that term, which implies a Laplacian, should be a harmonic potential. So this theory is Langmann-Szabo covariant. And the bonus is that it is renormalizable, indeed, in perturbation theory at every order. And this result, in the last 5 years, has been understood in great detail by Grosse-Vulkenaar and by the Orsay group. And it also seems to extend it is not restricted to this model, but it depends on the Langmann-Szabo symmetry. It seems to extend also to theories on curved space. But what was the unexpected bonus for us is that these theories are asymptotically safe. And I think that's why I was invited to this conference. So I will try to explain you, first of all, why they are renormalizable, and then why they are asymptotically safe. And then I will turn to group field theories and see whether we could expect that also there. And finally, there is a big quotation mark if all this has anything to do with what other people are doing and with the nature. So non-commutative renormalization relies, again, in this case, is a perturbative statement at all orders, for instance, and it relies on the combination of three elements. There is a scale decomposition, but it's a bit different. It mixes ultraviolet and infrared. There is a locality principle, but it's different. I call it modality principle. And there is a power counting, which again also is different, because it tells you that only the regular graphs diverge, and there is no way to see the regular graph in an ordinary theory without Riemann power. So the new scales are made like that. You cut the propagator, which is now no longer 1 over pi squared, but 1 over pi squared plus omega squared, into slices. And you see that the parametric representation of pi squared plus omega squared x squared is no longer based on the heat kernel, but on an object that mathematicians call the Miller kernel. So the Miller kernel is made of a piece which is a function of x minus y squared, and it has this tiny hyperbolic function. And there is a piece which is function of the x squared plus y squared, and which is reminiscent of the fact that there was a harmonic potential which attaches the points to a preferred point. So I should have said this theory is not translation invariant. So once you have this Miller kernel, you see that the scale analysis, if you perform it exactly the same way, saying, OK, I have a propagator, I apply my recipe, I divide it into scales by writing the parametric representation and cutting, then you see that the propagator at scale I has this behavior. You see, at the origin, you find again an ultraviolet singularity which is similar than before. You find again this scale behavior which is exactly the same in terms of the difference x minus y, so that in terms of the difference of points in the propagator, the large values of I indeed corresponds to short distances. But you find this other curious term, which tells you that the center of mass of the propagator, namely the average, if you like, between x and y, the quantity x plus y over 2, it is less and less tied to the origin as I goes to infinity. So from the point of view of the center of mass of the propagator, the I going to infinity limit is an infrared problem instead of an ultraviolet. That's why I would say that this new scale decomposition is neither ultraviolet nor infrared, but a bit of a combination of both. It's a kind of mixture of the previous ultraviolet and infrared notion. Okay, so that's about the scale decomposition. Then the next thing is the modality principle. So there it's more difficult to explain than just saying that, okay, the locality was so trivial, I said it was just like looking to a small object from far away, it looks like a point. This was really very clear. But modality is more involved. It tells you that when you look at certain graphs with scales which are smaller with respect to this new notion of scale, they look like modal products. So I have tried a picture of that so that you see what it happened. So the modal vertex in direct space, I told you it is non-local, but I didn't show you until now the kernel of this vertex. So the kernel of the vertex is made of a delta function, which tells us that in this bizarre world, the four particles, they interact if they meet at the summit of a parallelogram, that's the moment they interact. They need to be at the four corners of a parallelogram, whether in an ordinary theory, they need to meet at the same point. So they interact when they are at the corner of the parallelogram with this, because of this factor. But they have a strength of interaction, if you like, which depends on the area in dream of this parameter. And this is why this is Langmann-Szabo invariant, because when you go to momentum space, this thing transforms in an oscillation in momentum, and this thing into a delta function, so that you recover the same expression in x and in p space. Okay. Then why is it that this thing, when seen from far away in this new notion, or from deep away or whatever, in this new notion of scale, why is it that there is modality? It's like that. If you have external legs which are small in terms of the I index, and internal legs which are high in terms of the I index, and two vertices like that, for instance, what happens is that, remember that in terms of the distance between these two points, the high index contracts here because these points are very close in the, let's say, in the high regime. Therefore, this thing looks more like this, you see. These red lines have to be very small. So because of that, you see that the two parallelograms here, there is a transitivity that tells you that this side being parallel to that one, this thing being very close to this one, it's almost parallel to that. And then you have also a rule on areas, which tells you that the area of the thing you see, so from the point of view of the blue line, you see again a parallelogram, and its area is equal to the sum of these two green areas. That's why you see essentially a new modal vertex. Now you see that if I had switched these two lines here, and I contracted this one there and this one there by going to a non-regular graph, this rule of addition would not be true. So you see that it is much more delicate, and it has to require a regular graph. So it applies only to high subgraphs which are regular and not to the others. So, okay. But again, it's independent of the dimension. If you look at the same theory in dimension 6 or so, the modality principle also exists. Then you have the power counting, and you can establish the power counting because you have to combine now the integrations on the distance, on the differences of points, and on the coordinates of the centers of mass, and you find a more complicated power counting. But the outcome is that only the regular graphs with 2 and 4 external legs diverge and must be renormalized. So that's a chance, because that's the only one that the modality principle tells you can. I mean, the regular one are the only ones which satisfy the modal principle. But by chance, they just are also the only ones which diverge. That's why the theory can be renormalized. Okay. So then, the fact that this theory was asymptotically safe was not predicted by anybody until it was found. Okay, so it has been proved that it is asymptotically safe at all orders. And it means, if you like, that contrary to the ordinary 544 theory, in this theory there is no Landau ghost. That is, and because this theory has only half a direction of the renormalization group, that is because, if you like, there is no infrared problem because there is, if you like, this harmonic potential. It means that that is an example of a theory that should be controllable over all scales completely. And in particular, it's a theory for which we expect that we will be able to have a complete constructive control. That is, we will be able to prove that not only the perturbation theory is renormalizable, but it is Borel-summable. So let me explain why this model is asymptotically safe. Okay, I put a kind of ghost here, which is a Landau ghost. So, it relies on a combination of factors. Okay. The fact that the theory is non-local is perhaps one essential thing, because usually the reason for which you cannot find any mechanism to compensate for the growth of a coupling constant in the ultraviolet regime, which is the Landau ghost, is because you have no, for instance, you have no wave function renormalization at one loop. And the reason you have no wave function renormalization at one loop is because at one loop the only graph that you have is a tadpole for the two-point function. And the tadpole is exactly local, so it has no correction to the wave function, and therefore it doesn't give you anything at one loop. But in this theory, the tadpole is non-local. The tadpole is made of a parallelogram like that. So there could be a non-local contribution, and that's what happens. And then also, the presence of this auxiliary parameter omega for the potential is crucial, because it is automatically driven to a value 1, where the Langmann-Szabo symmetry becomes exact, and that's where the beta function vanishes. So it is not like, because there are some models in which you can find a fixed point by fine-tuning, but this is not the case here. You are not fine-tuned. If you start from generic values of lambda and omega, which are small, you are driven to the fixed point generically. So the way the fixed point is, the beta function, the vanishing of the beta function is proved, it goes like that. You have, like in any field theory, you have the Dyson-Schwinger equations, and they relate Green's functions at different orders. For instance, if you look at the two-point function, you could say the two-point function, the connected two-point function, for instance, is equal to the free propagator plus tadpole contributions, which I symbolically wrote like that, in which when you look at the first vertex, you know, if either there is no vertex or there is a first vertex. Either this first vertex also contains the other external line, in which case you have this drawing, or, well, it could be also true for ribbon graphs. You know, you could have this drawing of the drawing below. Or this vertex doesn't contain the other line, and then there should be a four-point function somewhere here, and here you could have dressing by two-point blocks. But certainly, then you could open a first line here, which would be a loop line, you see. You could say that you have a sum over all momenta of this thing. Now look at the blue thing. The blue thing plus these two propagators is now a four-point function, 1, 2, 3, 4. So it means that you have related the two-point function to the four-point function. But usually this is useless because then it doesn't give you a closed equation for the two-point function because the four-point function, if you want to continue, you relate it to the six-point function, and so on and so on. So the hierarchy of Dyson-Schwinger equation does not close, and usually you cannot solve them. But here, you have another element. You have a Ward identity. So the Ward identity that you have comes here from looking, it's a bit more difficult to explain. I wrote the Lagrangian of the theory in a different space than in X space representation, in a so-called matrix-based representation, which is a matrix-based where the star product becomes like an infinite matrix product. And then the Gaussian part is in blue here. The interaction here is there. This field is a matrix field. This is a matrix product and a trace, which I forgot to write here. And these are sources. And then you make the following transformation. You make a little infinitesimal rotation of this phi field, like that. And the Ward identities are best seen for a charge model, but they are the same for the scalar model, after one has understood them for the charge model. And one writes a kind of equation that this being a change of variables, the value of the integral cannot depend on the way you express the variables. So you have a delta of log z over delta m dA is 0. And then you to take two derivatives to create two external legs. And if you follow this procedure, remember the blue, these terms are invariant under this change of variables. But the blue one and the purple ones are not. And the blue one and the purple ones give you two contributions to this equation, which are there. Graphically, the blue term gives you this thing. The purple terms give you this thing. So let me explain. This comes with a factor B minus A, where this is the matrix MBA that you use. And here you have a matrix index A, which is changed by this insertion into another matrix index. Okay. So this is like a four-point function, but a special one in which two lines have collided. But you see, it allows to express a four-point function of this type in terms of a difference of two-point function. Now, if you go back to the previous equation, you see that the blue thing was precisely of this type because here you have an insertion in which two external legs come to the same vertex. So this four-point function is not any four-point function, but the collided sort of, the collapsed four-point function that the Ward identities allows you to re-express in terms of two-point function. That's why you can write the closed equation in terms of the two-point function alone. And from this closed equation, you can, first of all, yes, you have a closed equation, and you can prove that's in progress. That's work in progress. So we can prove that at the moment we have the proof that slightly simplified version of this closed equation is analytic in the coupling constant. When we limit ourselves to the, it gives you a closed, the closed equation that you get for this is in terms of the planar part of the theory. But so the planar part of the theory usually is analytic if there was no renormalism, but it is Borel summable if there are renormalism. But the fact that the beta function in this theory is zero tells you that you have no renormalism. So as a consequence, the planar two-point function is expected analytic, and this is in progress. So we should be able to prove analyticity in the coupling constant of the two-point planar two-point function from this closed equation. But what we have already, so this is not yet finished. But what is already finished is the proof that the gamma, the beta function is zero at all orders for this model. Now it should be possible also to prove that the Wool model, not the planar model, but the Wool model is Borel summable in terms of the coupling constant, either the renormalized or the bare one, because the difference between the two is finite. And this is also in progress, but this is more difficult because there, really, you have to resum the non-planar graphs and they diverge because there are so many of them, so you have to resum them. But this theory is stable, so there should be no problem. The 5-4 is a bona fide 5-4 with the right sign of the coupling constant, so it's stable. So another thing which is in progress is the fact that there is an anomalous dimension which is small and proportional to lambda in this theory. And I think all these things can be proved, and even the fact that the full theory is Borel summable in the coupling constant should be possible to be proved in this theory. But at least what is already done is that the coupling at all orders of perturbation theory doesn't move with a state. So this is the fixed point. And then one can also write the equations away from omega equals 1 and look at them numerically. And what happens is the following. If you start from a small value of omega, it will flow in the extreme regime. I would like to call it ultraviolet and infrared, to the value 1. And the coupling constant would start at the beginning, like in an ordinary 5-4 theory, but then it would stop to a finite value. So that is asymptotic safety in this model. OK. So are there? Well, OK. So I have still, I have finished what I wanted to say about this. So I would like to say in which there was another. Very interesting talks on other mechanisms for asymptotic safety. Is this a new mechanism for asymptotic safety? Yes, I mean, it is not. We saw mechanisms which are based on change of dimension. You know, you had an ordinary fixed point and you would change the dimension. Here we don't really change the dimension, like it's not a 2 plus epsilon or a 4 minus epsilon thing. Is it something which is due to adding bosons or fermions, or is it this conformal? No, I think it is something different. That's why I tried to call it a new mechanism. What is new in this mechanism is, I think, that the symmetry which is responsible for it, and the conservation law, which are reflected by the world identities, which are responsible for it, come from the non-local or matrix-like character of this model. And therefore, I think it's a bit new. And certainly what is sure is that it doesn't require any supersymmetry. Okay? So it has nothing to do with a beta equals zero model of supersymmetric Young means n equals 4. That's completely different. OK. So is there a hope that this mechanism will prove interesting also in quantum gravity? So let's try to answer this much more conjectural question that I would like to talk now briefly about group field theory, because in a way, group field theory is a class of model which seems to be a bit kind of generalization of this, because it doesn't involve matrix-like rebound graphs, you know, matrix-like theory with rebound graphs, but a tensor theory of higher order. So we would like to know if something of this kind, that is a soluble model, can be found, which would be not only asymptotically safe, like the Gauss-Kunar model, but also background independent. That is perhaps asking for a lot. So what about group field theory? So it lies at the crossroad between loop quantum gravity and simplicial quantum gravity. In fact, it was not really invented by loop quantum gravity, but people in loop quantum gravity realized that the amplitudes of the spin forms that they were writing were the same as the amplitudes of the group field theory. Because in fact, it came out from trying to solve the not using the Einstein-Hilbert action immediately, but using first the BF action. So it came from a route to gravity, which started from trying to sum over topologies rather than summing on metrics. And then we should try to improve the models to include the metric aspect. So it generalizes matrix field theory. It's an attempt to sum over discretized metrics and topologies of space-time. So why is it that so the underlying space on which the field lives is a group. And it could be, for instance, typically SOD minus 1-1 or SOD in the d-dimensional Euclidean case. And the idea that the fields live on a group is because you would like to represent,
related to some of our topologies. In fact, the written formulation of Bulatov was plain divergent when you try to include this information over topologies.
Okay, are you objecting to the fact that it was created by Bulatov?
Of course not.
Who created the group field theory?
No.
It's an historic question that I don't know. Usually people refer to Bulatov, but...
Yeah, well, I don't know about that, but I know, of course, that Bulatov, he created that model, and that this model is not summing over topologies.
Oh, why is this model not summing over topologies? Okay, so it is summing over something that certainly includes dual triangulations to manifolds of different topologies, but it's also summing over many other things.
But it's not Borel summable if you try to sum it over topologies.
But
if you fix topology, then it's well-defined theory. But if you include all topologies, then this group field theory is not well-defined.
It's certainly not well-defined. My purpose is to try to well-define it over the next 10 years or 20 years. No, it is not well-defined yet, of course.
But why do you then say that? I know Bulatov.
The 5-4-4 theory also is
He didn't attempt to sum over topologies.
Oh, yes, it tries to sum over topologies, yes. Because it includes triangulation of manifolds of different topologies.
But not in this. Well, you can write it down, of course, as a sum.
Yes. At the moment, it is a formal proposal.
You can always do, right? Sum over topologies.
For instance, the 5-4-4 ordinary model is not 25. Without cutoffs, you know, and it perhaps will never be, but the post-Kuhnau model is, but it's a modification, you know, it's a non-commutative space, and then there's a different propagator, and so on. But I think we have to understand first the 5-4-4 model, and then the 5-star-4 came. But perhaps in the same, I am not going to try to use the Bulatov model as a theory of quantum gravity, but it's a structure, you know, that attempts to, in a certain formalism, to combine different topologies. And the question of whether it diverges or converges is exactly the kind of question I am interested in, and I am working on. And I want to work on this. And I want also to work on its scaling and renormalizability properties. Okay? So it is an attempt, I should have put the term in red, an attempt to sum of a discrete metric and topology of space-time. And it is an attempt which, like everything, it has a sometimes it is fashionable, sometimes it is not. So at least why are the fields defined on the group? Because they want to represent holonomies, and holonomies are at the base, if you like, of how to represent a metric. And now it's a category of theories, because you can generalize it to four dimensions, still around the BF theory, that's called the O-Guri model, and then it can be generalized by incorporating in four dimensions further elements like simplicity constraints, and that is the subject which was active in the recent years in group field theory. So, but I will come also to these new models, but the simplest group field theories, they are topological because they are based on not an attempt to quantize quantum gravity, but to quantize BF theory. Okay? Yeah.
What is BF?
Okay, BF is a theory of gravity in which a topological theory of gravity in which you have a curvature F, and instead of having a two-form, which is, for instance, you can write a Lagrangian version of gravity in four dimensions in which you have a field by E, and you essentially have a curvature F here, and in these variables, the action would be the Einstein-Hilbert action would be written like that, and this is not every possible two-form. The BF theory would just be to take a curvature F and to multiply it by a two-form B. And then you would sum independently on B and the connection, which is here in F. And if you do that, you see that you get F equals 0 as an equation, because B exhaust is a Lagrange parameter for all the terms in F. So this would correspond to flat faces. You would have F equals 0 as equations of motion. So this is not gravity. This is, but in three dimension, you would have only an E and an F. So the BF theory in D dimension would be to put here a D minus 2 thing and an F. And then it would correspond to this equation. Then you can write down what would be the group field theory which would discretize this thing, and it would be the Bulatov model in three dimensions, the Ohm-Ruhmy model in four dimensions. But what I am interested in is to remark that these theories they have an interaction which glue together simplexes in D minus one dimensional simplexes into a D dimensional simplex. And the theory has a phi to the D plus one phi interaction. So in three dimensions, the Bulatov model has a 5-4 interaction. And in four dimensions, the Augury model has a 5-5 interaction. Very strange from the point of view of somebody who likes 5-4-4. Now it's 5-5-4. OK.
And then if you like loop quantum gravity, it's a good thing that these Feynman amplitudes coincide with the spin forms of loop quantum gravity. And if you don't like loop quantum gravity, you just forget this sentence. OK. So group field theory is non-local, certainly, because the propagator, well, is also formulated in a way which I don't like very much. Usually, the people of spin forms, or Bulatov himself, formulate group field theory without properly distinguishing between what is interaction and what is vertex. Okay. They call everything vertex, and they put a trivial propagator. I don't like this, but OK. So, all right. So. Certainly what it is non-local, and then if it can be renormalized, I expect that this renormalization will involve a new scale decomposition, and possibly we have to find the right propagator to make this model renormalizable, just like the Grünkenau model has a propagator which is not a naive one. It should imply a new locality principle. I would try to call it triangularity rather than modality. This principle should only for a special class of graphs. And it should involve a new power counting. Okay. And my hope is that some theories of this type could be renormalizable in dimension four, and then they could be candidates for a theory of quantum gravity. Then what steps have been done now are very modest. So for the scaling properties of the group field theory, usually the fact that there are infinite amplitudes in the Bulatov model is considered as a defect, but I view it as an interesting thing. The divergences are considered by the group, by the loop quantum gravity community to be of the infrared type, but I prefer to view it as the ultraviolet type because they correspond to short-range analysis on the group. And we have decided to try their systematic study. So what can be done? So first of all, this was a program started here by Fredel, Gouraud, and Oriti. They found a class of graphs in the Bulatov model that generalizes what are the one-particle irreducible planar graphs for matrix theory. And they could prove that, no, it's not true. I don't do proper justice to what you did. It's not just an inequality. It's a behavior. You could prove that the amplitudes of the Bulatov model for this graph with cutoff of order capital lambda scale as lambda to the power 3 b minus 1, where b is now the number of bubbles of graphs. And it's like the higher dimensional generalization of the notion of faces. OK, that was in May this year. Then we have got also scaling bounds. That is, we have rigorous bounds, not for a particular class of graphs, but for all graphs. So for all admissible graphs, we were able to prove that the amplitudes are bounded by lambda to the 6 plus 3 n over 2, where this number n is the number of vertices of the graph. And we can prove that you cannot do better without modifying the model, because this bound is saturated and reached for some classes of infinite classes of graphs. Admissible
is something I can define later. It's a technical point.
Sorry, yeah. I forgot. What was lambda?
Yeah. Lambda is a cutoff. Lambda is a cutoff which I consider an ultraviolet cutoff. Okay. In the spin form language, it would be a cutoff on the large spins of the model.
Okay.
In the Fourier-like application. And we conjecture that, in fact, if you take graphs without 2 points of graphs, you have an improved bound, which is in N instead of 3N over 2. So the effect in 3N over 2 could be removed if you knew how to treat well mass randomization in this model. Then, in order to prove this, a simple Cauchy-Schwarz technique is not enough, and there should be now a multiscale analysis, and we should be able to, we need a more powerful technique of the type that we had for, you know, we need a scale for the multiscale analysis. I can comment on this. Then we were also able to, we looked again at the Friedel work for regularization of this model. The Friedel work for regularization adds to the Bulatov model a term called the pilot term, which improves the, which is like a constructive regularization. You know, the Bulatov model has no positivity property. You can add a term to it which is positive. And then Friedel Wap proved that the partition function is more summable. But it's not very, there's not the right thing one should prove. It would prove that connective functions are more summable, like the free energy. So this is, we did that, and we could prove also how the Borel radius scales when the cutoff goes to infinity. But this is not a very satisfying result yet, because it shows that, in fact, the Friedel-Wap for regularization sort of reduces the, well, it's too strong for the model. We should find a lighter way of implementing a constructive regularization at large. Then there is an interesting possibility to have a simpler model in which we could perhaps go much faster for analysis of the full power counting property, which has been introduced by Gouraud in July, which he called the color model. And in the fermionic case, it has d plus one colors in d dimension, and they are on the vertex in such a way. So there is a symmetry in this model. All graphs are admissible. I have to explain, François, what this means. And also, the problem of the Bulatov model is that the dual of a Bulatov graph doesn't triangulate only manifold, but also pseudo-manifolds and even very singular pseudo-manifolds. And the colored models, they triangulate not only manifold, also pseudo-manifolds, but not too bad. So it's much better. And therefore, it seems much easier to complete the program of a complete power counting behavior for every graph for this model. And there is a kind also of Mathieu-Salam representation for this model that it doesn't exist for the non-polar model. So it may be accessible to better constructive regularization also. Then I will be very brief on how you would like to go from topological models to more reasonable models that would incorporate local degrees of freedom in four dimensions. And that has been the subject of a lot of activities in 2007 to 2009 around these people, Engel, Pereira, Rovelli, Friedel, Krasnov, Vivin, Special. And they have some proposal for a model which is better from this point of view. But what I would like to say is that they usually begin their papers by saying, we propose a new vertex. But I don't think they propose a new vertex. I think they propose a new propagator. Because I would say the vertex we should not touch. It is given by the topological BF theory. But what they do really is that they modify the propagator, but they call it the modification of a vertex because that's the language of spin form. But in fact, if you do really what they do, they do a new, they put a new intertwiner exactly in what I call the propagator. So they try to implement these simplicity constraints by relaxing, if you like, some rigidity of the topological model by inserting intertwiners. And that should make the propagator non-trivial. Because the difficulty of the problem of the Bulatov model is that the propagator is much too trivial. Okay, so there is some interesting results on this model. And I can comment. There is also a glimpse of normalizability, but I will be very brief. It's there is the first radiative correction to the coupling constant is logarithmic, and okay, that's the sign which is encouraging. And I will conclude now. I will go to my conclusion about that is extremely conjectural. Is there a chance that we find asymptotic safety in such a model? I think it's not impossible if we are bold, perhaps for the propagator, to find the right propagator. Perhaps we can include renormalization and asymptotic safety in such model. Because some elements which are responsible for asymptotic safety of the gross Vulcanar model are also present in this model. Okay. Logarithmic power counting seems to be present.
non-locality is there. There is an auxiliary parameter for the formulation of these models, which is the inertia parameter. Well, we might hope for asymptotic safety in some model of this type. I don't claim necessarily in the model which already exists, but some model of this type. And it is not clear at all whether this asymptotic safety is related and how it can be related to the fixed points which are seen in the FRT study. So my conclusion is that, anyway, renormalization is a critical test that group field theory should pass if we want them to become serious candidates. Asymptotic safety is there and is proven at all orders for the cross-functional model in four dimensions. It relies on non-locality and ultraviolet infrared duality. We may hope for such a scenario in group field theory. This is just for the moment a hope. And it is not clear at all whether we can connect, but it's also a hope we can perhaps connect this scenario to the emergence of medifold, which is seen in a different way in CDD, and to the fixed points, which are seen in FRT, and eventually, ultimately, perhaps, to the real world. So.
So now we have time for questions and discussion.
So. Yes.
Returning to the possible models, this decoupling of the Dias-Springer equations, does it also hold for the higher orders?
This decoupling, the Schwinger Dyson equations, you can always write. They are just a kind of classification of perturbation theory.
So, but usually, this is an infantile coupled equation.
Yes.
You showed that with using the symmetry constraint, you can decouple the 2-point
yeah.
Does the 4-point function also decouple from the 6-point function and so on?
Yes, absolutely. You can write also a closed equation for the 4, a closed equation for the 6, and essentially once you have solved the 2, you have solved everything. And showing that every fixed point function is analytic should follow easily, at least the planar part. And then prove that the complete part is Borel-summable should also be doable, but it's harder. But it's interesting also from the point of view of integrable systems to look at this closed equation. And you would find also it's also interesting from number theoretic point of view. For instance, in usual ordinary field theory, you find that there are zeta functions and number theoretic objects which appear in the dimensional regularization of Feynman amplitudes. But here they appear not only in the divergent part, but also in the non-divergent part of the function. So I think this is I think the cross-functional model is a bit like a kind of easing model for non-commutative theory. It's a thing on which you can have complete analytic grasp. So then it's worth to be seen. Even if it's a toy model, it's not quantum gravity. It's something you can completely understand analytically, and it's therefore an interesting mathematics structure.
So could you say that in a certain field basis, it's a free model?
No, it's not free at all. It's not free at all. In the ultraviolet, it is interacting. At omega equals 1, there is this integrated model. You know? And at lower values of MMA, it is not free. It's neither free, if you like. It is not free in any regime. It is interacting at every scale. It is not asymptotically free, neither in the ultraviolet nor in the infrared. How is it possible? It's because there is just a mixture of ultraviolet and infrared, and in that regime it is not free.
But generally, when you have a decoupling of the infant endpoint function, it means that there is a particle physics, there is a particle creation.
No. It's
so here, of course, I don't know what the meaning is.
The equation for the 2-point function is non-linear, and it doesn't mean that the theory is free. No, it doesn't mean that the theory is free. Of course, you see that all the planar graphs have the same value than in the ordinary fine for theory. So
certainly, it's not theory which looks like that, but yes.
Well, there is no, that's the problem. In that model, you cannot define the S matrix in the usual way because you have this harmonic potential. So the theory has not infinity states.
So normally that is corresponds to a conservation problem.
There is a conservation law for matrix indices at omega equals 1. But this conservation law disappears when omega is not equal to 1. So it's not trivial in any sense. What replaces the asymptotic state is in the sense, this metric space. And it is not trivial in the sense that at the model at omega non equals to 1, so along all this renormalization trajectory which I have there, the model does not conserve, has no conservation laws. Yeah, here. Okay. You are never here, really, at the fixed point. You are always on this trajectory when you look at any value of M and N. Here are the small values of M and N in the metric space. Here are the large values. So you are never at the point where you have exact conservation. And you are always in an interacting regime. And even there, it's interacting regime, but it may be an integrable system exactly there. Yeah.
But you say you don't have an S-matrix, or you do have?
No, you don't have an S-matrix in the usual sense, because you have no asymptotic states, because particle cannot escape the box. So this is a model which is not a model of R4. It's really a model of R4 with a harmonic potential. So that was if you want to use this model for particle physics, then there is a problem of how do you relate this model to the commutative world, and that's another issue on which I could comment, because then we need certainly another step, a kind of intermediate step. You cannot directly relate this model, because you need first to understand how do you remove this RNA potential. So it looks like a good completion in the extreme regime, sorry, which is there, but it is not realistic. it is not a realistic theory for particles in infinitely large space.
If you stop the potential at some point, if you can track that, in other words, and you don't let it go all the way, you stop it. What will happen to the model?
What we have done is we have defined another model with still a different propagator, which better connects to the it seems that either you have this model and it is asymptotically safe, or you have a model which better connects to the commutative world, which has a nice commutative limit, but then it has not the asymptotic safety property.
You lose the asymptotic.
Yeah, so we have to understand whether there is another model which sort of subsumes both aspects. And for the moment, we have not looked for that, because we have jumped into looking whether this model which has not background independence, could we find a model which has background independence, which is of this type? Because ultimately, that's what one you would like to have in functionality. So that's why we are now looking at the group field. Okay, so. Yes.
Well, one you used somewhere had a relativistic dispersion relation. But do you think that there can be some generalization, the non-relativistic dispersion relation?
I'm asking
what is probably similar to a Bose Gaussian harmonic trap, and also it has a right non-local interaction and so on. But maybe if you have a non-relativistic generalization, that might be possible to look at this experimentally.
Yes. In fact, I'm not looking really at a non-relativistic relation for the moment. So I hope to learn more about these aspects in the forward conference. I am certainly willing to get a lot of inspiration from condensed matter ideas, because I think the scenario that I could imagine for I would like to understand how models like the Bourdieu theory could have smooth manifold emerging, like the ones which are simulated in the causal dynamical calculation. And I think that what I can hope for, you see, is perhaps an analytic solution of some group field theory in an extreme regime, but probably I will have then a phase transition to understand a non-perturbative regime, because in this group field theory, it looks like the perturbative regime is you have few simplices, few vertices. It's like perhaps atoms of space-time or whatever. And then if you want a big manifold, you want to glue them in a coherent way, you want to have a kind of a phase condensation. And then this phase condensation is unlikely that I can study it without a non-perturbative mechanism. And this could come from condensed matter ideas, eventually. But at this stage, it's perhaps early to say whether it could be non-relativistic, inhomogeneous, and so on. That is not my specialty. I have looked a bit at this aura ideas, but I don't know what to think about them.
So if there are
yeah.
No question? No. If there are no other questions, maybe we should send the speaker.